Hi there, listener. It's Matthew. You've come looking for an episode of the Children's Book Podcast, and you've found it. Hooray! But you're probably wondering why the name of the podcast has changed. After 8 years of doing the Children's Book Podcast, I began a new career as head of podcasts at A Kids Company About, where I now oversee a podcast network dedicated to producing original content that talks up to kids, centers the things going on in their world, and engages and challenges how they see the world and themselves. All of the episodes of the Children's Book Podcast are still here, but now, if you're subscribed, you'll get new episodes of Worth Noting, a kids podcast about current events, hosted by me. Something for you and the young people in your life to enjoy together. Enjoy this episode, and I hope you'll check out Worth Noting and other podcasts from A Kids Company About. Meet Dan Santat, and meet a different Humpty Dumpty story. Welcome to All the Wonders, the Children's Book Podcast. I'm Matthew Winner. This is episode number 392 of the podcast with Dan Santat. And I'm just going to talk off the cuff here. This is Dan's third visit to the podcast. The first time, if you've listened before, is when he was debuting Beagle. The book was just about to hit shelves. It was his second picture book as author and illustrator, and it went on to become his first Caldecott-winning book. And it was this gorgeous story of a yet-to-be-imagined character who goes on a quest to find the person that will imagine him. Beautiful, beautiful story. Commanding illustrations. Amazing work with color. It was a wonderful story. He followed that up with Are We There Yet?, where he challenged the format of the picture book by having the characters travel back through time and having the readers manipulate the book to simulate that time travel. Dan returns today to share After the Fall, which is a new picture book about Humpty Dumpty, about taking that great fall and about the anxiety of returning, the fear of falling again. It's a beautiful story. It's a staggering story. It's one that, for me, was wildly important upon reading it, upon allowing it to live in me. It's one that I can't wait for you to read, for you to experience. I've read it to children. I've read it to other adults. I've read it with my wife. I've read it alone, and I've read it aloud. And it's a story that every way I read it, I see something new, and I love it more deeply, including reading it after speaking with Dan. So I'm so excited for you to listen to this conversation, for you to meet his new book, and for you to respond to it as well. I hope that you'll go online and share, whether through the comments on this episode, through Facebook, through Twitter. I hope you'll share with Dan, and maybe even with me, if you choose, how you've reacted to this story, how it's connected with you, and enjoy. Here's episode number 392 of the podcast with Dan Santat. Welcome back to the podcast, Dan Santat. I'm glad you're back, buddy.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thanks for bringing After the Fall. Thanks for writing After the Fall. Thanks for laboring over what it took to make this book what it is. I'm really impressed with this picture book, Dan, and I'm glad you're sharing it with us tonight.
Thank you. I'm excited to talk about it. It's been It's been a long time in the process of making it. So then this is like my first fall release. So I remember John Hsu was talking about it way back in January, and here we are 10 months later, and we're getting to that we're getting to the we're getting to showtime,
It's
I
getting,
think.
I was just gonna say, where the lights are coming up, it's almost time. This is great.
Yeah.
Well, for those that will be listening that haven't had a chance to see this book yet, do you mind sharing the story of After the Fall? And then I want to jump in, of course, to that rich backstory that goes along with this.
Sure. So, After the Fall takes place shortly after Humpty Dumpty falls off the wall, and I think it goes without saying, if you just say the name Humpty Dumpty, he's synonymous with falling. So, as a storyteller, just by saying Humpty Dumpty, you've already solved the problem of creating, a predicament, a situation, and I had always thought it would be a great opportunity to make a story about, I guess, overcoming obstacles in your life. I think it's something that everybody can probably relate to. And in Humpty Dumpty's case, it's his fear of heights. And so the story goes through the four seasons. It goes through summer when he falls off the wall, and then in the fall you discover that he has this anxiety for heights, and the seasons are starting to reflect his attitude about things and his mood, and then by winter he's reached an emotional low, and he tries to make adjustments in his life so that he doesn't have to face that anxiety of going back up the wall. And the reason why he likes going up to the wall is because he's an avid bird watcher, and it's the best place to go see birds. And he gets to this point where he's done everything in his life to try to, I guess, make things work. He tries to watch birds from the ground, but it's not the same. Then he adopts the hobby of watching, he gets into the hobby of building paper airplanes, and so that's just something that doesn't quite fill the void, but it ends up putting him in a situation where he ends up needing to face his fear and try to climb up the wall,
Yeah.
and that happens in the spring.
It's to not only parallel the seasons with sort of his attitude, but also with sort of these stages of grieving in a way that he goes through, this love of bird watching that he has. And in so many ways, I feel like I witnessed him give up on it, except that it wasn't going to be a thing that he could do anymore until he comes to that new season of being able to find a way to overcome that. I felt like was something that really spoke to me. And also with the color work that you did, there was a lot of evocative emotion in the color palette that you chose to use through all of these seasons. There was a lot going on here, Dan.
I find that color can be a very valuable tool in terms of eliciting emotion,
Yeah.
and the fact that it reflects the seasons really does help a lot. Tailoring the emotions of the seasons. He's at an emotional low in the winter where everything is very gray, very desaturated and cool,
Right.
and that just that you know that that already kind of elicits a feeling of melancholy and sadness. And by the time spring comes around, everything is warm colored and lush and green, and kind of signifies a rebirth, if you will.
Right. And the way that the oranges and tans pop on the bird that he ends up making, this paper bird that he ends up making, really feels like a golden promise. Really feels like something like turning over a new leaf.
And the thing is with that paper airplane is that I actually was looking up. I was looking up designs, and you can actually build that bird. Yeah, that's like an actual bird that you can fold. So.
Of course it is. Well, you were talking about color and using it to convey those emotions. One of my favorite spreads in the beginning of the book is where the text reads, and this is after we see Humpty has fallen and he's got some bandages over his like nose and cheeks. And it says, "After that day, I became afraid of heights. I was so scared that it kept me from enjoying some of my favorite things." And he's walking down the aisle of a grocery store with on the top shelf, oh, there's a wall of cereal. And on the top shelf are all the super most fun sugary things like Rainbow Bites and Sugar Bunny and Crunch Tiger. And then I love the way that the colors just gradient to gray and black shades down to a cereal called leaves and a
Yeah,
cereal called
leaves.
cardboard and fiber flakes. Bland. That was maybe my favorite. Bland.
My favorite of all the cereals was Sad Clown.
Sad clown. Next to, might I point out, next to winners.
Winner, yeah, right. And my little takeoff of Wheaties.
Of Wheaties, yeah, and
Yeah.
chicken feed. That was the, there were so many puns here that I was like, oh man, anyone who's walked down a grocery store aisle is going to immediately make these connections. But just to see the bright and fun, I mean, to associate for me, to associate grieving with also food and the way food can make us feel in that way of like colorful, bright, energetic, down to, oh, this is just really sad that I'm eating this food.
Right. I mean, it's the thing that the kids can relate to. What kid doesn't want a fun, sugary cereal with a free toy prize inside,
It was a
and
great
it
device.
clearly, yeah, and it just, he settles for, I think he settles for a box of bland.
It's bo the box that he's holding in the picture that I'm looking at is bow rings.
Oh, bow rings, that's right.
I love it. Oh my word. So one of the other things I wanted to talk to you about up front was from all of the books I've seen you do, I love your work. I know we've talked about this before. You've been on before, but you offered something so different in this book in your camera work, in your perspective. There was so much here that despite the text being Humpty narrating the story, there was so much here that felt like I, the reader, was standing alongside Humpty or looking out of a window or being on the ground beside him that just captivated me. One of the most striking illustrations I thought you had, well, the first was when he first sees the paper airplane pass by and he gets that idea of flying a paper airplane. We are down there standing on the ground almost behind him, looking up, and there's just this telephone pole jutting up from the ground, and we're looking up along the sight line of his binoculars. And I thought how much that felt like we were standing there beside him.
Yeah, no. For me, it was important to try to. You don't want to. You don't want to keep repeating yourself in the aspect of perspective. You don't want to continuously have a horizontal shot of him. Staring at a wall. And I also felt it was a missed opportunity if I didn't take every opportunity to, kind of give this feeling of scale.
Yes.
Being able to stand, in front of this giant wall, but to shoot from a low angle, it makes the wall more ominous. And then at the same time, when you're on top of the wall and you're looking down to the ground, I'm hoping to give this feeling of vertigo, that you can look down and it's a dizzying feeling that, it's a long way down. You want to look from his perspective so you can I think every child, even if you're not terrified of heights, there's always a I mean, I don't think I consider myself as a person who's afraid of heights, but like I was on the 12th story of the Flatiron Building at McMillan, and they had this staircase, And right in between, it went down in a spiral. And then if you just looked right down, you could see the hole that it spiraled around, and you could see all the way to the ground. Now, there's no way I'm gonna fall down that crack, but just by looking at it, it's dizzying. It's terrifying. And those are the moments that, you try to convey on paper. Perspective was a big thing for me.
You've given us so much too of looking back up at the sky. Not only how tall and ominous the wall is, but up there is the sky, the openness, the longing, where we want to be. We want to be up there with the birds. You know, birds are also so symbolic of freedom and of being carefree and to be grounded, as it were, literally. And figuratively for Humpty, and to be down on the ground and have those shots was so important. And then you bring us to this culminating factor that I don't want to give it away, but I certainly want to call out the shot because it's probably my favorite thing you've ever painted, which is that he makes this beautiful paper airplane bird, as we said, and he launches it into the air, and at one point we from a position in between the wall and Humpty, see a spread where our eyes can follow from left to right. Humpty looking off of the side of the page you've laid it, and an arc over the page onto the wall, as if like I could literally hold the book upside down and arc it with a paperback copy. I could just arc it, and that would be this world that this illustration exists in. And that, Dan, was something that you were talking about getting vertigo looking down on the staircase. That I felt the pit in my stomach watching. I could feel the height and I could feel the loss as we were
You're
following that
talking
paper airplane. The where
about the spread where he's about to lose the bird
I'm
to
talking
the.
about They Always Do. We have the
Oh,
spread that says, unfortunately, accidents happen, and we see in Humpty's eyes the slightest reflection of the silhouettes of the wall, and we turn the page and They Always Do is that spread that just it just captures me. It's amazing.
Right, that was. That's probably my favorite spread as well. It's I remember in my mind thinking in theory how I wanted to present it, and I wanted it to come off as like a cowboy standoff in an old Western film where
Oh, cool.
the good guy and the bad guy are facing off, and you see them on opposite sides. And I remember thinking in my head, the different ways I could portray it, and I wanted to just have this. I wanted to have this view that I don't know. Like in my mind, it sounded pretty cool to try to illustrate it this way. But physically, while I was drawing, I didn't know if I could do it. It was one of these things where I came up with an idea for the composition, but I didn't know if I was able. I didn't know if my ability was going to allow me to do it. And I remember drawing like 10 or 12 different thumbnail sketches, trying to see if I could do it. And it really was just blocking in shapes, just seeing if it made any sense. And when I finally managed to get it to work, I kind of stood there and I looked at it for a couple days, and then I let it sit for a week or so. For me, just kind of having these two adversaries face off. You have Humpty Dumpty, who is this victim of this fall, who now lives with anxiety, and now he's going to face off with this wall, which is this beast that cursed him with this fear. And then you're seeing this paper airplane flying towards it, kind of like the tumbleweed. that goes between the two cowboys.
Yes.
And for me, like, also what you also notice is that throughout most of the book, the sky is white. The sky is just, it's supposed to be blindingly bright that, you can't really see any details. And for me, that's kind of like a blank canvas. Like, to get to this point, then all possibilities are for you to decide. It's this blank canvas that you hope to achieve so that you can, maybe you can write the next goal in your life, to achieve the next thing in life. And so,
Yeah,
yeah, I
behind
mean,
that, obviously behind that wall, among that primarily white spread, but behind that wall or reaching over that white wall, you can see that yellow light peeking through. You can see
right.
that there's hope there, despite
Yeah.
it being this adversary that feels foreboding and feels like, I mean, you've got this wall that's like olive green and covered with all this ivy and just looks unforgiving. I mean, it even looks like it's not even this like beautiful smooth wall. It's all jagged and piecemealed together. This is an unkind wall.
Right. It's I mean, just to continue with the whole idea of white in the book, I was really obsessed with negative space. You have parts that are illustrated, but then you have parts that are just purely white canvas. And I was playing with it because I almost felt like it was a great way to subtly hint at, pieces of broken shell. If you really thought in that way, that like all the negative space just kind of looked like pieces of broken shell. And with this book, it's very sparse, but it allowed me to use subtle things that I don't think a lot of people will probably notice unless they're really looking at it. Like, for example, I like to use a lot of shadows. Like in this book, I was using a lot of shadows in the book. So I'll give you an example. So when he makes that paper airplane and he throws the paper airplane, you see the shadow of the wall on the ground. But then when
Right.
he sees where it's going, you get a close up of his face and you can see the paper airplane and the wall reflecting in his eyes.
Right.
And then you start seeing the shadow going over his face.
Going over him. Yes, it's eclipsing him. Yeah.
And then by the time it reaches the wall, it has completely covered his body. He is now completely enveloped in shadow. The moment of his loss, it's like the wall has eclipsed, his him again. And reflecting his emotions, it's like this beast that's leaning, looming over him, and showing him like, I'm still in control here, and it's up to him to climb out of that shadow into the white bright light,
I love that. Dan,
but for clarity, you had to have a very you had to keep it as simple as possible.
I agree, and I think that the what you've managed to accomplish in this feels so much like that artistic expression. Like you really struggled with, wrestled with these compositions in order to force us to feel along with Humpty Dumpty and to ultimately the reveal at the end, which I won't spoil here, but the reveal you have, I feel
Yeah.
like was a paradigm-shattering reveal for every single, and I've read many, every single Humpty Dumpty fractured fairy tale that I've read. It's never gone this direction. And yet, as I read this, I think, one, why hasn't anyone ever done that before? But two, this is exactly the direction it goes in. So I will just say, maybe perhaps we'll leave it with that Humpty is ultimately able to overcome his anxiety at the end, and in doing so becomes free.
Yeah, no, that's a good way to describe it. And I'll be honest with you, it's so the initial idea that I had for the book was that Humpty Dumpty is put back together, but there is one missing piece, and it's a piece of shell that's shaped like a heart. And in order for him to feel whole again, he realizes that that piece of shell is at the top of the wall. And that was the proposal that I had turned in to my editor, Connie Hsu. And Connie and I, we've worked on many projects together, and she's a very good friend. So a lot of our editing meetings are just us having, informal conversations while we're working on a manuscript. And she was pushing me to go a little bit further.
Yes.
And honestly, when we came up with the new resolution, I was actually the one that was a little nervous about the idea, because the way the resolution comes out, there are so many ways you can do it where it can be terrifying. And I would say that a good chunk of this time we spent on the manuscript had to deal with probably the last 6 or 7 spreads of the entire book. Because having the problem set out for itself, that Humpty Dumpty was afraid of heights and he needed to get back up, that was the easy part. The hard part was trying to pace out that ending so that it built enough tension and that you hit your aha moment at the right spot. Now, there are a lot of times when you can write a manuscript and you can say, I want this to happen. And I guess the best way to equate it is, like, when you're drawing, you might have an image in your head and you say, I want to draw the image that I see in my head. And chances are that's probably not going to be exactly the way it's pictured in your head, but you're close. Now in this case, we had this ending in our minds, and we kept doing revision after revision because it just didn't feel right. And we had all this time before the deadline to really nail it. And I spent a good 3 or 4 months just trying to fix that ending from, the right angles, the right words. And it was boggling. It was really frustrating me. I mean, we did about 16 drafts of this thing,
Wow.
and a good maybe 10 of those drafts was just trying to get the ending right. And so when I talk to people who read the book, I ask them, well, where is that aha moment? Is it the page before or is it the very last page? And everyone says it's the last page. And I'm a little shocked. I'm a little surprised because I think you look at it from an adult point of view, and then you know certain things about the characters, and you think to yourself, oh, they're going to find out. Oh, they're going to find out. And then you forget he's an egg. I think that was the thing that I heard from everybody, is that you forget
Exactly.
that Humpty Dumpty's an egg.
You forget that Humpty Dumpty is an egg is exactly it, because the line of text that I won't read beyond this, but the line of text that is so beautiful and I think so beautifully captures the backstory that we'll talk about in a second is, maybe now you won't think of me as that egg who was famous for falling. Hopefully you'll remember me as the egg who got back up. And on that spread, Dan, I know full well that if I was reading the pictures more closely, I should get it. But it was the next spread where I was like, wait, what? Wait, what was happening to me? And it all came, I think, when you talk about editing to get those beats right, how fast those last spreads came from that line to the back cover was mesmerizing to me and felt just like a master hand at work on this story. The labor you put into that, you and Connie put into that, was tinkering and tinkering to get it just to this was a perfect ending. I can't imagine it any other way. So hopefully when you reached this point, you had that feeling as well, that this was it.
That was great. I think the reason why Connie and I work so well is because we have we have this equal mutual respect for one another. Like, I hear her opinions, and she hears my opinions, and we'll
Yes.
go away from a phone call and we'll get back to, a conversation, and we'll take a good amount of time to think about what the other person said. Now, throughout the entire, I would say not until, I would say for the first 14 drafts, Connie was adamant that the story should not be written in first person. She thought that third person was the right way to do it, and that, there's a lot of ways to screw up writing it in first person. But from my point of view, I thought that writing from Humpty Dumpty's, voice would clarify a lot of any question about what actually happens in the end. And for the first few drafts, I said, Connie, you really have to let me try this in first person. She's like, nope. Let's just figure it out visually. And then we get to this point where I think we did everything we could do visually to explain how we want the story to end. And we kept tinkering with lines written in third person, trying to say, okay, this is, when you start writing in third person, it starts getting a little preachy, and you're thinking, okay, let me just try to write in first person. And she said, okay, well, it better be good, because I already have 1 foot stepping out of the first person circle. Like, I don't like the idea. And I wrote the draft, and she took it, she read it, and the next week she said, okay, you know what? You're right. You're right. I'm wrong. It's way better in first person.
What I love about it being in first person, to bring up the dedication that it's dedicated for Leah, it's dedicated to your wife. I love that in a story about a character trying to overcome anxiety, that you've given the power to that character. You've given the strength to the individual that has the struggle. And I feel like that then allows the overcoming of that anxiety to have that much more power.
Right. I think maybe people have heard me in other interviews, but this story is dedicated to my wife. It's a love letter to my wife, who's spent most of her life dealing with anxiety. And it was this thing where, reflecting the way Humpty Dumpty was dealing with his situation, my wife avoided certain triggers so that she wouldn't have that kind of anxiety,
Of course.
and it's perfectly fine. You can live a perfectly normal life, just doing that. But then, a couple complications come when you have kids, and when they're young, they want to do certain things, and you can't really necessarily explain why they can't do certain things which are out of your comfort zone, if you will.
Yes.
And I mean, having two kids, it can be a circus. And my wife was always about just controlling the environment, making sure that things don't stress her out. You have kids, that gets thrown out the window. And it just it and after the birth of our second son, we didn't realize this, but in retrospect, we realized that she was going through some postpartum depression. And I mean, from there, it was just a slippery slope where she just kind of got dragged down to this really bad place. And she shut down. And it was hard to from As a husband, it was hard to communicate with her because she would describe it as survival mode. It was, I'm just going to push everything away and I'm just going to deal with myself. And that's not easy when it comes to a marriage,
Of course not.
and so, my wife got into this point where she was just kind of obsessed with her work. She didn't have time to deal with the kids. She was tired all the time. She was going through depression, and I was feeling alone. I was all alone, and it was this thing where if you tried to talk about it, there would be this backlash of just like, don't try to change me. Don't try to, don't try to, you trying to make me something that I'm not. And more or less, I found that I'm arguing with this person, but the argument's not really with her. It's with the anxiety,
Yes,
you know?
I was going to bring up about the anxiety being separate from her. Exactly.
And it's like we're fighting for this person. And the person feels helpless, to this fear. Like fear is just a, it's a fear is such a horrible, horrible thing. And we got to this point where she didn't want to listen to anything I had to say. And I think that was part of the explanation of why I was working so hard, because she kept wanting to quit her job because her job was providing so much anxiety for her that she felt like if she could leave her job, then maybe her problems would get better. And I knew that if she quit her job, she would come home and she would just be depressed. It would just be, now you're depressed, but you don't have a job. And oh my God, I remember asking her and saying, do you wake up every day terrified at what the world's going to do to you? And she says, yes. And I said, well, do you like that? And she says, no. And I said, well, do you want to change that? And she said, I don't know how. And that was when I realized, for everything that I tried to do to help her, and there was a part of me that said, if I could make money, one less thing for her to worry about, maybe problems will be solved. And that was the reason why I did 13 books in 1 year. When I reflect on it, a lot of our problems were that we were dealing with was right before Beagle was released. And I was going through a lot. I was going through a lot of stuff. I was just trying to keep a family together, trying to take care of the house. My wife was in rough shape, and I'm still trying to, meet deadlines, thinking, okay, money will be one less object that she has to worry about. So we got to the point where I said, listen, if you want to quit your job, I don't want to hear it anymore. You have no reason to complain about it anymore. And I think she looked at it and she said, wait, what? And I think she took a good long hard look at herself and she said, well, wait a sec, maybe my job isn't the problem. And it was just this weird thing where she didn't want to change anything. It was, like the deer in the headlights. You're so terrified that you just don't move and you just freeze and you don't do anything. That was her for like a good 6 months. And it was, I have to be honest, like maybe a more patient man would have handled it better, but I was infuriated that I was killing myself to try to fix things. And she, I don't know, like she was too scared to do anything. She lost this fight, she didn't want to, she didn't know what to do. And it was at that point where I realized, I don't know if I can be married to this person. I don't know if I can live the rest of my life like this. Because every Sunday would come and she would dread the week. Now, I understand people hate Mondays. I understand that maybe your job can bring you down. But from a scale to 1 to 10, 10 being a total state of panic, to 0 having absolutely no anxiety at all, it got to a point where she would start the day at about a 6 or a 7. And that just brings a constant tension to the family, to the point where, oh my God, my wife and I, we would argue in front of the kids, and it starts affecting the kids. And that's when you have to put your foot down and you have to say, look, you need to do something about this anxiety, or else we can't be married. And her father, her father suffered through a lot of this when, through his life and his, his marriage with Leah's mother, and they're still married. But I remember he called me, and I remember I would spend hours talking to Leah's parents. Leah's my wife. I'd spend hours on the phone talking with Leah's parents because I needed to vent to somebody. I needed someone to talk to because I felt like I was all alone, and my wife wanted to hear nothing of it. And I remember my father-in-law calling me, and he said, "You need to tell her that you're going to get a divorce. Like, you need to tell her that it's you or the anxiety." And I remember thinking, like, I don't know if I can do that. Like, that's, I don't know. I don't, that's a really bold step that I don't know if I can take. I mean, I've had thoughts about it, but I don't know if I don't know if I can do it. And he said to me, he said, if Leah's mother didn't do that to me, we probably wouldn't be married right now. And I remember saying that to Leah. I said, okay, if you don't get help for yourself, I can't be married to you. And, with a total amount of resentment, she went to the doctor. She did, she would talk for a good 5 or 6 months, thinking about, talking about, like, breathing techniques and things like that. I think she got to the point where it just wasn't helping the marriage. She would have these breathing techniques to the point where the breathing techniques just annoyed her. Trying to talk yourself to a calm place was just, it was completely inaccessible. And she was never big on taking, taking drugs, and it got to this point where she said, okay, well, I tried it your way, and I said, look, maybe you should try drug therapy. Cause there was a point where it got so bad that she was starting to have, like, these obsessive compulsive tendencies, that were just really harmful to her. And I remember at one point I had to say to her, like, does this feel normal to you? Like, you're doing this thing over and over and over again. Like, do you think that's right? And that was the moment she realized that she had to do something. And so she ended up getting medication, but she was very resentful for it. She would look at me and she would take the pill and she would say, oh, is this what you want? You want me to take a pill so I'll be quiet, so I'll shut up for you, And I remember thinking, like, look, I want my wife back. And a good 4 weeks into it, it started taking the edge off the anxiety. And it actually created the opposite effect because her anxiety went from, like, an 8 or 9 down to a 6. It gave her more anxiety because she felt like her body wasn't constantly warning her of danger, and then that was a bad thing.
Oh no.
That she had lived with anxiety for so long that by having less anxiety, it felt wrong. Like, she actually took comfort in having that anxiety with her. And, I remember 4 months, 4 weeks into it, she said, something's not right, something's not right. And I had to tell her, and her parents had to tell her, stick it out for the 8 weeks, like the doctor said. And she did. And it was like a complete transformation. And it was like I got my wife back. I found the woman that I loved in college that I married, And so that's where this book comes from for me. It wasn't a battle between me and my wife. It wasn't even a battle between me and the anxiety, but it was a battle between my wife and her anxiety. And it was very obvious in retrospect that only she could dig herself out of that hole. And so, she finally got control of the anxiety, and literally 4 weeks later, I won the Caldecott Medal. And from a family point of view, like that was like this thing that took our marriage back to this brand new level of like it was like we rediscovered our love. It was like, to this day, here we are, what, I think it's like two and a half years since the incident. And, people tell us, like, you guys act like a newlywed couple. Like, you guys act like you've just been married. And, and it's great. And, we're only here because she decided to face her anxiety. And so that's why the book is dedicated to her.
Well, I think that in living with this. In living with this with Leah, in loving her through it, in trying to help her in all of these things, and all in the life that you lived, right? The way that this story came out, the way that this story manifested, in whatever seed of a way it began, but to bring it to where it is now, is a gift to be able to take something that was so destructive and turn it into a force for good, and turn it into something that people can see themselves in, whether it's the adult reading to the child and having those feelings and identifying with those feelings, or whether it's the child themselves that's struggling with these feelings and having them be unfamiliar and not knowing how to name them. I'm grateful, Dan, that you went here with After the Fall, and I'm grateful that you came out on the other side with this book the way that it is, and that it in such a beautiful way expresses your love for Leah as well.
Yeah, there was a lot, for me, it was very emotionally heavy. When I finally finished it, I showed Leah the color spreads. They sent us the FNG, and I remember she looked at it, and she saw the graffiti on the wall of the book that said, for Leah, and it had a little heart on there. And she read the story, and she ended up, I remember she ended up crying. And the fact that she was so open and willing to let me tell this story, because I remember when the book was done, and I said to her, I said, well, we're probably going to be I'm probably going to be doing interviews, I'm going to have to talk about this, and I asked her, I said, I just want to know if it's okay if it's okay for me to talk about this and be open about it. And she said, without any hesitation, she said, look, I want to help people, as much as I can. And, if as painful as, our experience with it was, if it can help people, if it can help kids, then by all means, tell them everything. And she was so, and this was really touching. She was so touched by it that she actually went out and got a tattoo of a bird feather on her back.
Nice.
It was crazy,
That's cool.
and now she's hoping that I will also get a bird feather tattoo on my arm. So I guess I'm getting a bird feather tattoo.
Yeah, I mean, I think you should. I think that's a good thing. I love that. Oh, my word, my heart is full of love for you. You were saying that she read it and cried, and all I could think of is, Dan, every adult that reads this book is crying. Like I cried, my wife cried, I've read it to some friends, they've cried. Like this is a book that I think echoes truth in a way That is hard to deny. And again, the artistic approach that you've taken is just, it's masterful. And so this is a book I think that is hard to deny.
Thank you. I think just from what I gather, I've been getting quite a few personal emails from fellow children's authors and librarians. And what I'm discovering is that there's a lot more people out there with anxiety than I realized.
I would believe that.
I didn't realize it was such a thing. I was at a book festival, and I was on a panel with an author illustrator friend, and I was talking about After the Fall, and that friend pulled me aside after we were done with the panel and was like, did you say that your wife has anxiety? Because there are times when I feel like I need to run out of a room because I'm just completely overwhelmed by a situation. And it was just, it's these moments where people are very open with me because I'm being open in public that I find very endearing. And I'm not saying that everybody should go out and get medicated. I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with living with anxiety. Like there's people that deal with it different ways. I just know that from my personal experience, I wish everybody could live without anxiety. Like I have a personal animosity with anxiety because I know what it can do to people. And so, from my personal experience to this book, I hope it can help kids. I can help, just maybe recognizing it and knowing that other people have it is a big step.
Yeah. Dan, why don't we end our conversation tonight by speaking directly to those readers that will encounter this book, to those readers that love your work, that or even are on the other side of discovering your work for the first time. I'll leave you with this question that I know we've talked about before, but I'll see a library full of children tomorrow morning. Is there a message to close out our evening? Is there a message that I can bring to them from you?
Yeah, don't give up. In life, I think optimism is the thing that drives us. And if we don't have hope, if we don't have optimism, then it's hard to face each day, Just know that things get better, and you are not alone. And just never give up.
This podcast is recorded and produced by me, Matthew Winner, in my library studio in Ellicott City, Maryland. You can subscribe to the podcast and access the archive of over 350 episodes at All the Wonders, a home for readers to discover new books and to experience the stories they love in wondrous ways. Go beyond the book at allthewonders.com and check out other podcasts from All the Wonders, including the Picture Booking Podcast with Nick Patton, a semi-weekly podcast about picture books and the people who make them. And Books Between, a podcast hosted by Karina Allen, helping to connect kids ages 8 to 12 and their parents, teachers, and librarians with the books they'll love. Our theme music is by Emily Arrow. All views and opinions expressed on the show are those of the individuals, myself included, and do not reflect any ideas or viewpoints of the publishers of the books referenced. Listeners, if this episode connected with you, I'd love to hear it. Leave a comment on allthewonders.com or rate the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher through stars or reviews. Sharing the podcast with friends through Facebook, Twitter, word of mouth, or any other means helps reach more listeners, which leads to more content and more amazing guests. And that's a very good thing indeed. Coming up on the podcast, Nidhi Chinani shares Pashmina, her debut graphic novel. See you then, and thanks for listening. We know you value what you put in front of your kids, especially when it comes to screens and podcasts. That's why we're excited to share a new podcast from our friends at Sleepiest, creating bedtime stories to help your kids fall asleep fast.
Hello, Abby here. If you've got children and find bedtime's a struggle, I'd like to tell you about Coco Sleep, a children's story podcast designed to make bedtime a dream. Coco Sleep turns a chaotic bedtime into cozy bonding time. The stories are delivered in a pace that gently slows. Rumour has it that no one's ever heard an ending. So search Coco Sleep on your favourite podcast app and let's make bedtime a dream. That's K-O-K-O Sleep, and I'll see you there.